This is going to be for sure a test of skill and time management for me. Something that I actually excel at, if you ask my wife. No, I don't. It was actually brought to me this morning that they asked me, how are you going to go through 8 pages? Well, I'm not. I wasn't planning to. I do want to skim as much as I can, give as much information as I can with the time that we have. But there is a lot more information there. That's for you. That's for you to go home and read more. So it's just extra information that you guys can have. So we're just going to get started. I know we have a lot of ground to cover. I do want to get as much as I can. I just want to ask how many of you, I know in the area that we're at, it's probably going to be rhetorical, but how many have had interactions with Mormons at your door, work, school? It's a lot. So there's a reason for that, and we'll get to that. But I do want to say something that there is a desire that I have to talk with Mormons. It is out of love for them. So with classes like this, the point is to proclaim truth while also exposing lies. But this is not meant to be a gotcha class when you talk to Mormons or talk to anybody that is part of these counterfeit gospels. It's not to to continue to have the upper hand in an argument. This really is to stir on a love for those who are outside of Christ. And the question does come up pretty often talking with Mormons is, are Mormons Christian? Mormonism, Christianity, are they compatible? The quick answer is no, or else it wouldn't have been part of this series titled Counterfeit Gospels. There is, there should be a love and a desire to proclaim Christ to them. So we're going to get started. Mormonism teaches that the original church founded by Jesus fell into apostasy, something that's pretty common with these movements. Foundational truths were lost and confused. The organization authority established by Jesus was forfeited. As a result, God chose Joseph Smith as a prophet to restore original Christianity. The appearance of the Book of Mormon serves as a bridge of this restoration of Christ's subsequent return to earth. For example, LDS believes that God predicted the Book of Mormon in Isaiah 29:14, where he said, "Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among these people, even a marvelous work and a wonder." They believe the Book of Mormon is prophesied in multiple passages, especially in the Old Testament. Now, quickly, I do want to refer to this resource, Understanding the Book of Mormon by Ross Anderson. There's great volumes that you can get from Christians who have written about Mormonism, but this, I would say, was probably my favorite because this guy was a former Mormon. Or is a former Mormon. He is a Christian. But the way that he explained things about his personal life, but also the doctrine of Mormonism, was so clear and profound. And even when you talk to a Mormon, you can get blindsided by one of their doctrines. And you're like, well, I don't know what to say to that. And they're like, well, see, you don't have the revelation of God. He has a way of going down this main line of Mormonism. And then he'll take a nice little detour quickly without taking us into the other county. It's just a real quick and you're back on the road. So it doesn't leave you questioning like, well, can we talk more about that? He just answers it right away. So I do recommend it, Understanding the Book of Mormon by Ross Anderson. He has another one, which the name is escaping me. So the reason why I asked how many of you have interacted with Mormons, and I knew there'd be a lot, because there is currently, as of 2023, there are 17 plus million members worldwide, 6.8 million in this country alone, and I'm sure it's growing. It is one of the world's fastest growing religions and cults. If you see there, Islam is considered the fastest. In Modesto alone, and I looked it up, and also just the amount of times I've driven all around Modesto, There are six wards. Wards are just the regular Sunday meeting places. They're very different from a temple. I think the other temple is in Oakland, and it's this extravagant, beautiful, I'm getting nods, beautiful building. But if you happen to drive down Pellendale, turn left on Dale, you will see a massive construction site of another extravagant building. There's a lot of money going into it. There's a lot of land that was bought. There's a lot of businesses that were proposed to be bought out so that this construction site can have that land. And that is the new Modesto Temple. It's estimated to be finished in 2026. So I would imagine that there's going to be just an influx of more Mormons. And so I'm going to say Mormons or LDS throughout this class. Mormon isn't a derogatory term. A lot of Mormons that I've encountered would prefer not to be called Mormon. So I do respect them and call them a Latter-day Saint or whatever. Actually, I'm not going to say whatever they desire, because the full name is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Now, the reason why I only stick with LDS members or Mormons, I'm choosing not to say the full name, is because there's a truth claim that I'm not comfortable in saying when I'm referring to Mormonism, and that is the Church of Jesus Christ. The Church of Jesus Christ is us, not just Christ's community. In theology, there's the visible church and the invisible church. So the historical biblical churches down the street, we are brothers and sisters in Christ. So that is the Church of Jesus Christ. And considering what we're going to learn today, I cannot refer to LDS as the Church of Jesus Christ. So there is some prehistory that I think is really important as a backdrop for Mormonism. It was pretty surprising. There was so much I wanted to put in there, but there's not. So the backdrop of LDS, there's a lot of occultism happening in the area in which Joseph Smith, the Smith family, was around. In Middleton, Vermont, which I believe that's where Joseph Smith was born and his family resided in for a while, Middleton, Vermont was an area that was frequented by the Smiths pretty often. In that town, there was a man named Nathaniel Woods, and he created a cult called the Fraternity of Rodsmen. And this was formed, he formed his own church after he was excommunicated from really an Orthodox church. He was offered a job, and then they heard him out, and they were like, yeah, you're not going to work here. And that was probably for the better. But some of the core tenets of this cult, of this church is, one, members were the new Israelites. And I want you to keep that in mind. There was a day of reckoning where God would destroy all the Gentiles. So keep those two in mind. This next quote by Peter Lavenda from his book, The Angel and the Sorcerer, he said the fraternity began receiving instructions to build a temple since they were informed that they were descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. So this, Tuck it in your mind just for a little bit when we get into as we travel through this. Now, the demographic of Palmyra, New York, which is where the Smiths would move, according to their historical records at that time, that town was associated with a lot of witchcraft and superstition. Many false prophets came and went out of that city. And in all that, this is all happening in the time of the Second Great Awakening. The First Great Awakening, it was pioneered by Jonathan Edwards, I'm sure someone that we really appreciate, considered probably the smartest man in America, considering what he accomplished at his age and just really who he was and how he was able to accomplish things. Also, another pioneer would have been George Whitefield, which I'm sure a lot of us would appreciate. I know some have read his biography, read his sermons, and are just greatly encouraged. He's someone I really enjoy reading. So then we have the Second Great Awakening, where we have a bunch of people saying, oh, well, that was that was an interesting movement. They're getting a lot of attention. They're probably getting money to fund their ministry. I'm feeling I got something to say. So then they start rising up and they're like, okay, so hear me out. Let me say this. And so you get some pretty interesting people coming out of the Second Great Awakening. It's not a good movement. Bruce Shelley, who is a church historian, traveling from month to month through dark forests, the men naturally acquired a pensive and romantic turn of thought and expression. Hence, the preaching is of a highly popular cast, and its first aim is to excite the feelings. The country opens a boundless theater for strong, earnest, and unlettered eloquence, and the preacher seldom has extended influence or usefulness who does not possess some touch of this power. That's just a really nice way of saying, oh my goodness. There was a lot of people that came and went. There was a lot of figures that would rise up and then just falter out really quickly because there would be a movement. Then they start really hearing what's going on and what they believe. And it's like, okay, we're going to steer out of that. So there was a lot of people coming out of the Second Great Awakening. I even tried looking up some, and it really, they're just really short histories of some of the movements that I found. There's not much to it because they would have, they just came and went. There was no influence, or not a strong influence. So that's the backdrop of Mormonism. I really think that is important as we go through their beliefs. Just a quick history of LDS. This movement is considered to be a revivalist movement, and that is along with Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventists, and Christian Science. And they're all founded around the same time, within 50 years of each other. So there's just a lot of revivals happening. They want to try to mimic the first one. And so you have a bunch of cults within those 50 years of each other. And they all come with the belief / revelation that all other Christian, specifically Protestant denominations, are wrong, or they have been corrupted, has fallen into apostasy. And almost every Christian cult has an emphasis on the apocalypse. Now, we have an apocalypse doctrine. We have a doctrine of end times. We have an eschatology. We have it. We see it in Revelation. We see it prophesied in other places in our Bibles. But the difference between how we would or how we should talk about the end times is, one, we don't know when it's going to happen. I never say that it's going to happen next week or whatever. It may happen by the end of this class. But I'm not going to prophesy and say, oh, it's going to happen around 10:30. But we do believe that Jesus is coming back. That's a for sure thing. He's going to come back physically. He's going to return and gather his people. The issue with these kind of cults is they're naming dates. You'll see one from Joseph Smith pretty soon, but he did prophesy that Jesus would come within 56 years of the time that he prophesied it. And this is in the 1800s, and we're clearly past 56 years. And so Joseph Smith, he did attend Methodist and Presbyterian churches. Growing up, Methodist is a lot different back then than it is now. In 1820, Smith claimed to have a revelatory vision of two divine beings who he said were God the Father and Jesus Christ. Excuse me. They told him again that all Protestant denominations are wrong. To me, that's pretty convenient. And this is considered the first vision. And then in 1823, he said that an angel named Moroni showed him several golden plates with religious inscriptions on them. And that is considered the second vision. To a Mormon, the first vision is where church history starts. Because like these two personages said, oh, everything has been corrupted. It's been wrong. I'm choosing you to start this right now. So to a Mormon, church history starts in 1820. And then in 1830, the church was founded by the name of Church of Christ. And then in 1838, it is changed to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Now, a quick biography of Joseph Smith. I know it doesn't look quick on your paper. My keyboard came up. All right. He was born in Vermont, 1805. His parents were practicing occultists. Smith's father practiced something called dowsing. Has anyone heard of dowsing? No? Okay, I figured there would have been because it has to do with searching for water when you're drilling, right? So it's what it is today it's you have these two L-shaped rods and you hold them out like this. And when you are walking on the ground looking for a place to drill and you don't want to hit water, you don't want to hit a water pipe, those rods would go like this, or they would end up pointing outwards. And the claims from these guys are like, I promise you, I'm not turning my wrist, I'm not doing this, it's doing it by itself. So the joke is, I don't recommend doing it, don't ever do it. The joke is, between two Christian friends of mine, is that one of them, their company does dowsing. He actually stays, it's not his department, but they know that they do it, and so his friend makes fun of him, saying, "Oh, your company practices witchcraft." So it's pretty. There is YouTube videos of legit construction workers doing it. It's pretty. To me, it's creepy. And so also Smith's father, he practiced something called scrying, which is peering into a mirror-like object. Water or into something to receive information. So think of the tale of Snow White, where the witch would peer into what? A mirror. And she would say, she would try to receive information, mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the fairest of them all. Now, of course, that's a fairy tale, but that is something that was practiced in that time. And now Smith's mother was, she was recorded to be a palm reader. And also, they were most likely a part of that fraternity of rodsmen cult. I do believe that you are a product of what you grew up in. And so, considering what this fraternity of rodsmen cult believed, I do think it was passed down, or even Joseph Smith would have heard his parents talking about it. excuse me. Joseph Smith learned something called treasure digging from his father. Now, treasure digging doesn't sound as bad as it looks, but it is really bad. Treasure digging is not just going out and finding buried treasure from a pirate's map where X marks a spot. It is actually a con man's game. Treasure digging was the belief that spirits were in control of treasures that were hidden underground. These spirits, it's recorded, these spirits are referred to as gnomes. That's just a fun, interesting fact. But in order to find this treasure on some land, which usually it was someone's owned farmland, they would have to perform certain rites, certain kind of rituals in order to receive that information to go and find it. Now, the reason why it turned into a con man's game is, and Joseph Smith was doing this, that he would go to a farmer and say, "Hey, I believe that there's some treasure in your land. But the thing is that I need some money to build some resources, be able to find it, spend months on someone's land, and really just stealing money." So that's where it turned into a con man's game. It's a pretty wicked thing. So it really, again, keep treasure digging in your mind. There's a lot of stuff I want you to hold on to. In Palmyra, New York, during his first vision, he's around 15 years old in 1820. Now, official Mormon doctrine will say that it was 1820, but in some of Joseph's letters, he's recording it as 15 years later, around 1832 to 1835. But in this, so you can see where Joseph Smith's integrity is going. He saw these two distinct personages in, this is important, separate form, God the Father and Jesus Christ. And the Father introduced the Son and said, "This is my beloved Son, hear him." And then Joseph Smith asks, "Well, which church is true?" Then God the Father instructs Smith to not join any of them, for all the professors are corrupt, all their creeds are an abomination in God's sight. They confess him with their mouth, and they have a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. Now, after this vision, Smith continues to treasure dig, continues to practice occultism. Now, the question is, with someone who had a vision like this, do you think they would have lived a holy life, right? So why would God call, come to somebody, and then this person would continue to do what God is calling an abomination? I would imagine that Joseph Smith did understand a little bit of his Bible and understand his Old Testament to an extent to know that God condemns divination, a lot of this witchcraft, a lot of this stuff, and treasure digging and scrying and dowsing is a part of that. So the question does come up, it's like, if you had this vision and God is telling you to start this whole thing, you need to stop doing what he thinks is an abomination. Something to think about. So going to his second vision in 1823, we have the angel Moroni, and it appears to him over a period of 9 hours overnight. Interesting. Interestingly, Joseph Smith, along with his friend Oliver Cowdery, the night before they were out, they saw this angel. They were out treasure digging. Now, to connect this with some of Smith's continued occultism, there was a commonly known book called The Magus. The details, it details how to do these rituals, but it also states that the veil between God and man is thinnest on September 21st. If you just look back, you'll see that's the date that the second vision happened. Now, some Christians will say, well, I think Smith just probably made all this up and made up the golden plates and all this stuff. And then some will say, I think he saw something similar to Muhammad when the angel Gabriel appeared to him. So I'm not going to tell you where I stand on that. But there are those two where, one, you can say he is a complete liar and just made up a bunch of stuff. And two, he actually saw something appear to him as an angel of light. The angel Moroni informs Smith that there are golden plates that are located on Hill Cumorah in the same area, and they contain the Book of Mormon. Now, this angel gave Smith something called seer stones. He called them the Urim and the Thummim, and these seer stones are stones used to receive revelation from outside oneself to gain wisdom, and in this case, to translate ancient texts. Smith would put his face in his hat, peer into these stones, which is form of scrying. He's putting his eyes into just blackness to receive information, and as he's doing that, an English translation of this ancient text would appear, and with the help of Oliver, these words would be written down and, of course, turn into the Book of Mormon. Those are the first two visions that are referred to a lot when speaking to LDS members, on face value, I'm like, I don't get it. And I really mean that respectfully. These are some just wild things that are happening in Joseph's life. Throughout his writings, there are some recorded sermons, and he has made prophecies that did not come to fruition. For example, Smith then stated that the meeting had been called because God commanded it, and it was made known to him by a vision and by the Holy Spirit. For the coming of the Lord, which was nigh, even 56 years should wind up the scene. And that was spoken in 1835, and 56 years later, nothing happened. So already, we can see from Joseph Smith that he's a false prophet. In Deuteronomy, you'll see that even if they get it wrong once, that's it. You don't need to worry about them. They're not speaking from God. So the way this class functions, and in fact all the other classes are functions, we want to focus on three things. One, from these false religions and cults, is when we want to focus on what their authority is, what their scriptures are, how do they compare to the Bible, and the nature of God, which includes the doctrine of the Trinity, who is Jesus, and then also, lastly, salvation. How is one saved in these religions. So today, I do see the time. We were just going to focus on the authority, and Lord willing, next week we will get into the nature and doctrine of God, and then we'll talk about salvation, and then hopefully some practical evangelism tips when talking to a Mormon. I do apologize. I'm sure everyone has been just as sick throughout January, so we're in recovery mode. Along with the Book of Mormon that was given by Angel Moroni, there are three other authoritative scriptures. You have the Doctrine and Covenants. That's one book. The Pearl of Great Price. Oh, thanks, bud. Pearl of Great Price. And then you have the KJV Bible Translation. Now, LDS is pretty much like a KJV only movement, but also Smith has his own translation of the KJV version of the Bible. Historically, Christians, us, have seen the Bible as the sole, infallible, and sufficient authority for Christian faith and practice. Mormons do not believe that the Bible or even their scriptures contain all of God's word. Joseph Smith says, we believe all that God has revealed, all that he is, does now, which is a continuing revelation, reveal, and he will believe, and we believe that he will yet reveal many great and important things pertaining to the kingdom of God. Just quickly, I think we'll just focus on the Book of Mormon and Doctrine and Covenants. Now, there's some interesting things on the Pearl of Great Price in terms of think about it, we'll probably go back to, but there are some views of who God is, how is one saved, the nature of man, and the nature of Jesus. So we'll just stick with the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine of Covenants. The Book of Mormon, again, functions as a sign validating Smith and his work. If the Book of Mormon is true, then Smith is a God's appointed prophet, and the church he founded is the true agent of God's kingdom. The Book of Mormon is a collection of writings and teachings of the ancient prophets and followers of Jesus Christ who lived in the Americas from approximately 590 BC to AD 421. Prophet Smith translated the Book of Mormon by divine inspiration from gold plates that he received from Moroni. These plates were supposedly inscribed in a script called Reformed Egyptian, and from scholars, it's not a real language. It's not written down. It's not spoken. It doesn't exist. Within the Book of Mormon, it's mostly history. There are some views that come up. But it is mostly a history. It is presented as an ancient account of the ancient inhabitants, Jaredites, Nephites, and the Lamanites of, and they were in America. And these people are considered descendants of Israel. Does that sound familiar? And they are the principal ancestors of the American Indians. And also great cities, peoples at war, and the rise and fall of nations are recorded. These groups are said to have originated in the ancient Near East. The Jaredites made their way to the Americas after the Tower of Babel events, while the Nephites and Lamanites made their journey shortly before the fall of Jerusalem in 586 BC. The climax of this book is the appearance in the Americas of the risen Christ, and that is in the book of 3rd Nephi. Mormons see these as the fulfilling of Jesus's fulfilling his words found in John 10, that there are other sheep that are not in this fold. They're using John chapter 10. And if you wanted to, Pastor David just preached through all of John, and you can go find John chapter 10 and see what that passage means. Jesus' appearance ushered in a renaissance, but the inhabitants soon devolved into warring factions again. The landscape of this history is primarily seen in Central America and Mexico, so Mesoamerica. But the archaeology scholars in that area has failed to unearth any concrete evidence of the Book of Mormon. One BYU professor said that no one has found any inscriptions or evidence for or material remains that can be tied directly to any of the persons, places, or things mentioned in the book. I just see some chuckles. This didn't happen. None of this stuff happened. The timing of some of the events along with actual history does not match up. In the Book of Mormon, it mentions something called metallurgy, which is the process of refining certain metals, gold, iron, stuff like that. But metallurgy wasn't introduced into Mesoamerica until centuries after the Book of Mormon story supposedly ends. So there's mention of steel swords. Steel swords weren't a thing in Mesoamerica. Even the using gold as currency wasn't a thing. Gold was just traded. It wasn't considered a currency. There is a view of Jesus, God, human nature, salvation, and many other important topics in the Book of Mormon. But certain doctrines, core doctrines of LDS, is not found in the Book of Mormon. So we see this continuing revelation. Surprisingly, I found it really surprising that the Book of Mormon is filled with references to Jesus. For example, 600 years before Christ, Nephi, he's a character in that story, had a vision of a virgin birth, John the Baptist, Jesus' baptism, his miracles, the calling of the 12 disciples, and Jesus' death on the cross for the sins of the world. And there's a reference there in 1 Nephi. Also, passages foretell in detail about the life and ministry of Jesus. Jesus appears on average about every two verses in that book. Now, the interesting thing about these kind of prophecies about Jesus is if you just even look at what is summarized here, this is a full-fledged New Testament gospel, naming John the Baptist by name, the calling of the 12 disciples, specifically 12, Jesus' death on the cross, and in detail, the rest of his life and ministry. Now, what's interesting about that is that this is before Jesus, the incarnation, right? But what's interesting is that this is a full-fledged New Testament gospel. Why are we not seeing a full-fledged New Testament gospel in our Old Testament? So it is a skill of convenience that in the Book of Mormon there is specific prophecies when in the Old Testament to God's prophets these prophecies I'm not saying there wasn't prophecies, but those prophecies were pretty veiled. They were foreshadowing. It wasn't specific, like, hey, nowhere in Isaiah or anywhere else will say, hey, by the way, when Jesus is born, he's going to have his cousin, John the Baptist, baptize him. We don't see that, but for some reason we see it here. So something really to think about where it's the timing of when the Book of Mormon was written and who Joseph Smith was, knowing his Bible, knowing some good doctrine, and now all of a sudden that's, these prophecies are in the Book of Mormon and not in the Old Testament. To go on to the to Doctrine of Covenants, I do want to end here, maybe end with some application. These are made up of numerous revelations from Joseph Smith, 135 out of 138 chapters or sections. There's also two official declarations, one in 1890 and one in 1978. And these were pivotal moments in LDS history that was used for the future, the direction for the future of the church. There are sections that relate to development of church bodies, defining the offices and governing bodies, and there are some future prophecies of the second coming of Jesus. So in this list, there are just some summaries of some of the sections, and we'll get to some of these doctrines when we, Lord willing, next week. So section 76, those who attain the highest level of heaven are called gods. So the question is, can men become gods? Section 88, heaven has three distinct levels, a differing glory, and I'll have something written on the whiteboard next week. You have the highest, which is the celestial kingdom, then the celestial kingdom, and then the lowest is the terrestrial kingdom. Their version of hell is just something called outer darkness, and we'll get to that when we talk about salvation. Section 93, human beings are eternal and uncreated, and the soul is divine in nature, meaning that before we were born, our soul was living eternally in heaven. And then when our parents, when we were conceived by our parents, then we came down from heaven and into our human form. So we must have lived in a past life together and known each other. There is a doctrine saying that you are born by God the Father and one of his spirit wives, and you grow up as a spiritual body, and then when it is time to go to earth, you are sent to earth, and somehow you forget everything that you lived in the spiritual realm. Section 128, baptism is performed for the salvation of those who are already dead. 131, eternal marriage, so you're married for eternity, is a requirement to be able to get into the celestial kingdom. Eternal marriage continues the family unit even after death and is required to become a god, which is why polygamy was something that was encouraged. Now, in 1880, there was a declaration called the Manifesto, and it banned polygamy. Polygamy is still practice, I don't think in California, surprisingly, with California's understanding of sexuality. But there is two sects, and I'm not focusing on this. There's two sects of LDS. There's your Latter-day Saints, and then you have your FLDS, the Fundamental Latter-day Saints, and they are the ones primarily in Utah, and they are, if LDS is a cult, FLDS is a cult. And I not joking, it is, it's wicked. There's a lot, there's definitely polygamy, and a lot of those girls are very underage. So that's FLDS. I don't want to focus on the doctrine of polygamy throughout this, because just in California, it's not something that's pretty popular. So just want to focus on the core stuff. In 1978, the priesthood was granted to worthy men of all ethnicities. So around 16 years of age, if you were a worthy man, you would be deemed a part of the priesthood. This is important because black people were seen as cursed to have blackened skin. That is part of a grand story, which we'll get into in the nature of God. Just quickly, there was a great war, like in our theology, a third of Satan's angels turn into demons, and then of course those who remain faithful with God, there was a third group who were neutral, and those, because they were neutral, they were cursed to have black skin. Brigham Young, who is the second president, he believed that when the church would allow black people to be part of the priesthood, then the Mormon church would have fallen into apostasy. So it's really, he was a blatant racist, and it's just interesting to see that this is part of their doctrine, and yet you have someone thinking that if this happens, then the church is in apostasy, and now it is happening. So with Mormonism, quickly, that Mormonism is an ever-changing religion. There is a way of gaining revelation, one from the presidents. And actually, there's a current president. He's the 17th. His name is Russell M. Nelson. Kind of wanted to point this out. He is 100 years old, and he's still giving revelation. It's weird. I really don't mean that disrespectfully. It's just there's something to that. But also there is something called your testimony. This is a weird question. Does anyone follow Mormon influencers on Instagram? So one thing that my wife pointed out to me is there was a woman who was struggling between the church's doctrine of modesty and what she wanted to wear to the beach. This is really just kind of an out there example. You can also do with their belief on not having caffeine. But the point is that their testimony is really what drives their life. So if the church is saying modesty, you got to remain modest, you got to wear certain clothes. But then if she's praying, asking for wisdom, and she's really thinking that the Spirit's like, this is okay if you wear this to the beach, then that's okay. So there is a continuing revelation within Mormonism. So I bring that up because there is some liberalism going into Mormonism. A lot of the priesthood are part of the LGBT community, which was deemed an abomination around the time of Joseph Smith. So you can kind of see the progression of progressive theology in the Mormon church. Lastly, I do just want to finish with some application. The veracity of the Mormon scriptures, Smith's character, and the prophecies are frequently called into question, like the archaeology stuff, and then again, Smith's integrity. Deuteronomy 18 ought to be in our view when examining these scriptures and Joseph Smith. And if you say in your heart, how may we know the word of God, word that the Lord has not spoken? When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the word does not come to pass or come true, that is a word that the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You need not be afraid of him. Also, I would just compare the character of Jesus. First Peter will say that he did not commit any sin and there was no lie found in his mouth. And then look at the character of Smith. He was a practicing cultist. He was a con man. He made many false prophecies about what would happen in politics, of course, what happened in Jesus' return. So, and you'll see this in many of the other characters that we'll go through in Islam and I'm sure Roman Catholicism and in New Age stuff. So look to Jesus. That would be one quick application. Lastly, the Old and New Testaments are alone the inspired and infallible revelation of God in written words. There are some verses there to refer to. God has given grave warnings about adding or subtracting from his word. The Bible teaches that many false prophets will arise and propagate destructive heresies, and the Apostle Paul charged believers to be diligent in preserving the truth of the gospel against false gospels proclaimed by men and angels. And it's interesting that Galatians 1 was spoken at the first class when Paul is saying, even if we were given a gospel by men or an angel, they are to be cursed. And it's interesting that that's part of the of LDS history, is that an angel came and gave him a different gospel. When you're speaking to a Mormon, in terms of just talking about the authority that they are under and that we follow, which is the Bible, if possible, I would use a King James version of the Bible. There was a Jehovah's Witness came to our house and he asked if we had any Bibles. And he was kind of discouraged that we didn't have any King James Bibles. We had ESV, which is the Elect Standard Version. But one of the things he wanted to go through was the introduction of the Bible, where it talks about how this was translated, that it is confessed that, like, yeah, our translators inserted words into the Bible, like and the and commas and other grammar. So to a Jehovah's Witness and even to a Mormon, it's like, you guys are adding to the Bible. You should be cursed. And so King James Bible is a good Bible. It's hard for me to read. I do plan on wanting to read more from it. But if possible, read the scriptures that are here from the KJV. It does kind of take away the barrier between you and a Mormon. And then focus on the Bible's prohibition about the continuing revelation from Joseph Smith, all the presidents, and even your own continuing revelation. So I hope this helps. I would look at the Pearl of Great Price stuff, and I think that was all that I left out for the sake of time. So there are any questions, I will try to my best to answer them in the time that we have. Yes.
Do they recognize the errors? You know, we talk about the sole authority in the scripture and the infallibility. Do they recognize the errors in their scriptures?
Yeah. So there's like excuses made. So for the archaeology stuff, and actually, now that you bring it up, it's good to go to the Book of Abraham, which is in the Pearl of Great Price. A museum exhibitor came to Mormons and sold them four mummies and some papyrus scrolls, and Smith declared that one of those scrolls was the writings of Abraham while he was in Egypt. And so he translated it just quickly. In Abraham's vision of the universe, he learns that God's throne is found near a star called Kolob. In the same vision, there are depictions of human spirits, intelligences, being eternal and uncreated. And in a great council, making decisions prior to being on this earth, also an account of creation portrays multiple gods involved. Now, the issue that comes up is those papyrus scrolls were lost since Smith died, and they were found in 1966 by New York City's Metropolitan Museum of Art. And a portion of that scroll that Smith translated was analyzed, and it did not match up at all. It was actually an Egyptian ceremony on how to do a funeral, and Smith took that and applied it to how Abraham would have seen things. Now, what comes up is, well, one, that's probably the wrong scroll that they found, right? So there's one excuse. And then the other is, well, what was it? Maybe this was the catalyst to what we would believe. So even with the archaeology stuff in the Book of Mormon, it's like, well, it just hasn't been found yet. So they do recognize that Smith is not wrong. It's just probably he hasn't been proven right yet. Yes.
Do they see America playing like a part in like the end times in a way that like the Bible doesn't refer to America?
I don't know if America specifically is like a like the end all be all of the end times, but the Americas do play a significant part of where the Garden of Eden was, where the Ark is. I think the Ark is in Kentucky, and it's not the Ark Encounter. The Garden of Eden is in the beautiful state of Missouri, and so there is some. America does play an important role. I haven't read anything when it came to like his second coming, but his first coming to America was the catalyst for.
Wait, he came to America.
Yeah, that's the climax of the Book of Mormon and Third Nephi.
So are they like from Israel?
I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't. I do. Well, they're a part of. They're considered to be descendants of the lost tribes of Israel,
okay.
Right? So, I don't know about the current political climate. I haven't seen anything today about the whole Middle East stuff going on.
This angel Moroni, is there any like? Is it just like a special angel of many, or like what is their understanding of angels and how like the influence of you know,
like other angels?
Or just wondering, like, because Moroni had a pretty significant role in kind of, and just wondering, like, where, what the base, their understanding of the basis of this angel was, or like, who this angel was.
So, like a doctrine of angels, is that where you're at? Or, like what was the significance of Moroni?
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's really all that I have seen from when it comes to Moroni was just this vision. I don't really see much of angels. I mean, there's angels in the Bible, so I would assume that they would adhere to a doctrine of angels. But in terms of their scriptures, I don't really see much. There's a focus on the eternality of human souls and then becoming gods and stuff like that. So angels, I mean, they do have a doctrine of angels and demons in terms of that great war. So I hope that helps. Yeah.
When you talk about the testimony, you know, where they get these testimonies that they can do things, is that the same as the burning and the bosom that they would always refer to?
Yeah, so that burning in the bosom is, from what I've seen, is when a Mormon is trying to evangelize to you, they really encourage you to read the Book of Mormon and pray about it. And then if you have an experience, or they almost expect that you would have an experience, that experience validates the Book of Mormon is of divine origin. So that burning in the bosom, specifically with the Book of Mormon, is like, oh yeah, well, I'm feeling it. It's true. And it's the same thing, because they use James to ask, James says, ask for wisdom. It's that where, let me ask for wisdom about modesty or about caffeine or about who I'm going to marry, whether it's going to be of the same sex or of a different sex. So, yeah, the burning of the bosom.
And then I was just curious with his parents. You said his parents really knew cold. He went to a Methodist church. I don't know if his parents were in that church or not, but do you have any...
Yeah, that's not...
...on the parents joining Mormonism later on with him or anything?
I haven't seen... I didn't see anything from his parents, but so that is not clarified, and I apologize, but they would have bounced around. So the Smiths were kind of like a secretistic people, where they would take from all over. And that's pretty much what New Age is and occultism is. So yeah, they would have been in part of that cult, the Fraternity of Rodsmen, and they would have joined other churches. And so you can see in the life of Joseph Smith that he knows his Bible, he knows the words of the Bible, but in terms of the interpretation and application, doesn't know.
So with the angel interpreting or giving them the information, from our understanding, like, either he's lying and made it all up, or he did see something. So if he did see Moroni, do we understand that as like the same as like automatic writing from a demon, or is this actually like, what do we understand it as? What is that to us?
So you kind of see where we would stand on the belief of did Joseph see something or did he not see something? I would believe that he did see something. In terms of automatic writing, that's a whole different thing. I think he actually saw something, considering what he was doing, and yeah, and something disguised as an angel of light, because it clearly wasn't an angel from the God that we believe. I believe Colossians 2 would say, do not be captivated by elemental spirits and stuff like that. And he says that before or after the proclamation of Christ's death and resurrection, putting to open shame dark forces. So are we good on one more? Okay, we'll wrap it up. Thank you, guys. Lord willing, we'll be back for part 2.